Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online, downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive. Hi, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called Marketing Secrets Learned in Prison. It's an interview with legendary sales coach Ben Gay III. Ben Gay III is a world-renowned sales trainer and author of The Closers. He's worked with marketing giants like Earl Nightingale, Zig Ziglar, Ray Considine, and has helped countless businesses increase their sales performances. Although Ben ran a prison program for 5 years called People Builders that taught prisoners and staff alike how to set and achieve goals, it wasn't until he was sent to prison himself that he learned some of the most valuable lessons about business and life. So in this audio, you'll hear Ben's incredible story about how he was railroaded on multi-level marketing charges and sent off to prison, but how he took his sales training with him to help the people around him turn their lives around, all while virtually running his business from behind bars. You'll also hear the truth behind Ben's indictment and the one mistake he made that got him 15 years in prison, what Ben knows about Earl Nightingale that most people don't, secret techniques Ben's learned from Ray Considine for network in even the strangest places, the cheap trick Ben's wife used that almost bankrupted his business while he was in prison and how he got it all back, an almost magic way to command respect anywhere. Ben had everyone calling him Mr. Gay in prison, even the guards. The one and only proven effective sentence to use in marketing that gets a name out there, even when no one has heard of it. It would have been easy for Ben to just sit around and do his time for the 6 years he was in prison, but instead he took his show on the road and taught everyone he came in contact with how to effectively turn even the most negative of situations into a positive one. Thanks for listening. Now let's get going.
Because I was through dealing with the Nightingale Conant Corporation. We were their biggest customer probably 10 years before he returned from college and the other business he was working.
Was it through Holiday Magic?
Yeah. Earl was the voice of Holiday Magic. Earl and I were very good friends. Lloyd and I had sort of a pleasant business-like relationship. He didn't underestimate the value of the business we gave him, but he considered me sort of an irritant. Earl had asked me at one time if I'd like to move from Holiday Magic over to Nightingale Conant and help him build the business. I think I've told you this before. Earl was a great philosopher. He was a terrible businessman. And the reason they became partners, the real reason is Lloyd was his printer, and Earl owed Lloyd a lot of money. And so basically, I can drive you into bankruptcy again, or I can be your partner. My copy, for instance, of The Strangest Secret, the record, I've got one of the original 1956 recordings, shows on the back cover. If you want to buy more of these, please contact Lloyd V. Conant, distributor. He was just an independent distributor, but he was also, more importantly, their printer.
Who got The Strangest Secret album and message so popularized?
Earl, to answer the question, because he was on the radio, he had his own five-minute commentary called Our Changing World, an opportunity to promote his own stuff, and he was an announcer on The Big Gun, WGN, which is a Clear Channel radio station, you know, after sundown. All the people on that number have to shut down their stations or turn them way down, and then the Clear Channels then boost all over the country. Earl used to say if you squatted down by a barbed wire fence, you could hear his radio program after 5 o'clock when it went Clear Channel. He had plenty of opportunity to do his own promotion. Lloyd was a typical distributor buying records and selling them.
How about through Holiday Magic? Did y'all push that message to all the distributors?
Oh, sure. It was required. Came in their opening package. We did The Strangest Secret, Lead the Field, which is a series of recordings, sort of son of The Strangest Secret. Earl made a mistake many people make in their careers. I may have made it myself, in that he did his best work first, The Strangest Secret is a classic recording. And then he spent the rest of his career trying to top it, lead the field with Son of The Strangest Secret, taking major points in The Strangest Secret and trying to turn each one of those into a 30-minute message. And it was good.
But it wasn't like
Strangest Secret. Yeah. And then he did The Complete Speaker, and that was a total bomb and made a lot of money being the voice of. He did a ton of recordings for us. And he did them for Beltone. Have I ever told you the Beltone story?
Is that hearing aid?
Yeah.
No, tell me about that.
It's a cute one that you just ought to put in your memory bank. Sometime there may be an opportunity to bring it up. We had decided to use Earl to help our distributors. You know, it's hard to get people to do what they're supposed to do. So we had a Flexi record. You remember those?
A Flexi record?
Yeah, they'd be in magazines.
Yes.
Yeah, they were made by Evatone in Chicago, and Earl had a connection with them. So you could put a Flexi record in a magazine, for instance. You ripped it out. It was square, but it was small enough where it didn't interfere with your arm on the record player. And you could send somebody a recording. Well, we bound them in little booklets. One was called Invitation to Success. The point being, if you're not brave enough to walk up to somebody and say, you know, I want you to come to a meeting, how much are you making, we can help you make more, blah, 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 take this recording and just hand it to people with your business card, and Earl Nightingale will invite them to the meeting for you. And then after the meeting, you handed them another one called Passport to Success, and it sort of recaps what you just heard in the meeting and said why you ought to go forward. And then once you were a distributor, the news was broken to you. I told you this in our interview. The first $2,500 didn't really get you in the prime position. The prime position was general distributorship. So he recorded one for us called The General Idea. So there were three that I remember off the top of my head.
How did those records do? Did it work?
Oh, sure. It wasn't life-changing, but it got people who couldn't do anything to do something, and then over time they learned and maybe didn't use the records as much, but it helped us with the weaker people. But it was a huge help to a lot of people. And plus, it gave us a degree of credibility, because by then I'd created that sentence I told you about. Of course you've heard of Earl Nightingale, the most listened to radio voice in the world, heard daily on over 750 radio stations in the United States and Canada. That's how we got around people after I quickly discovered no one had ever heard of Earl Nightingale, percentage-wise. Just like I say to people, of course you don't know Zig Ziglar. And 9 times out of 10, they go, no. If they're not in selling, you know, haven't been to a motivational seminar, they've never heard of him. That astounds me. To this day, you'd think everybody would have heard of him by now. So anyway, we created that sense. So if you handed it to them and they never played it, but you told them, this is a recording by Earl Nightingale, he's the voice of Holiday Magic. And of course you've heard of Earl Nightingale, the most listened to radio, blah, blah, blah. So it was a tremendous help in that regard. So anyway, as we go back, I was back with Ron and Les Davis. They were the sales managers of the company at the time. No relationship, but they were. And I said, my only question is the quality. Maybe we ought to put it on a small, real record. Well, the Flexi records were 11 cents a piece, and the other ones were more than that, enough to make a difference. So I said, if you got any around that he's done? They said, we got a shipment here, ready to go out. This is the Christmas message to Beltone hearing aids distributors. And I said, great. So they go out to this substantial pile of addressed things, pick out one, bring it in, put it on this little record table in the boardroom. And the background story of this was, when Earl read it, he was a cold read. You just handed him a script and he could sit down and do it. And he worked with an engineer who knew when he heard a 3-second pause, Earl was done. He hit the end of the thing. And the engineer was so tuned in to Earl that when Earl semi-retired, moved to Arizona, the engineer and his wife went with him so he could continue recording down there. They were like McMahon and Carson, except you never heard the engineer. So anyway, with total trust in the engineer and his ability to cold read, he picks up the script and glances over it right before they start, and he says, oh, I don't like this. You know, Earl was a serious guy, and this thing is full of Yuletide greetings for you and yours, and Beltone and Santa Claus love you, and it was too gooey. So he called somebody and handed it to him and said, call Beltone and tell him I'd like to edit this thing. And they came back and said, Beltone doesn't want it edited. He said, well, I don't want to do it. And they said, well, the account hangs on it. And this was in the days when Nightingale Conant was hanging by their fingertips at all times. So with that financial fact in mind, he recorded it. Blah, 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 and Yuletide greetings, and Santa Claus loves you, and Beltone holds you dearer than anything in the world. Yuletide greetings to you and yours. Thank you, this is Earl Nightingale. And then he counted 3 beats and said, Jesus Christ, what a crock of shit. And because of the way they'd worked together, Earl trusted the engineer. No playback was done. He knew when he got something right, and the engineer must have been reading a magazine or something. I'm making up numbers now because I really don't remember, but like 10,000 records going out to the distributors and all the Beltone.
That's hilarious.
But anyway, I'm sitting there in the boardroom with Ron and Les and blah, 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 and Gilti Green, to you and yours. Jesus Christ, what a crock of shit. And they dove on top of the record player. And then the stuff in the lobby already had postage on it. It was ready to go. Then someone said, the mailman, threw their bodies over that pile. And Earl went to his grave believing they had destroyed all copies. Somewhere in my stuff, and if I ever find it, I'll send it to you. When they went out of the room to stop the mailman, I took the one that was on the record player and put it in my briefcase. They thought they were all destroyed, but one wasn't. So anyway, that was how Earl worked with us and so on. So anyway, then I went on Programmed Warmth, if you want. Programmed Warmth and having secret relationships with everyone is one of my secrets in doing business. I am really a warm and lovely guy. I have a little harder edge to me than some people in my business. But I know how to be warm and friendly, and I know how to send out birthday cards and so on. And my wife laughingly calls it Programmed Warmth. It's important it get done, but I can't remember 1,000 birthdays. So it's handwritten, but it's part of my day every day to go down the list and handwrite things and mail things and put the stamp on slightly crooked. And the secret relationship is sort of an odd thing to describe and discuss, but I'll give it some thought. And these are those nuances and subtleties that I say in my seminars. They didn't pay me $10,000 to come here and read you a $25 book, so I'm not going to cover anything in the book except by happenstance. I'm going to cover the nuances and subtleties that are the difference between one guy making $500,000 and somebody else in the same office making $100,000 with the same lead, same pricing, same structure, same everything. One guy is a sales infiltrator, last chapter in the Closers Part 2, best thing I've ever written about selling. And the other guy is a technician. Knows what to do and calls on 25 people a day or makes 25 phone calls and sends out follow-up packet. Whatever he's supposed to be doing, he does it, but he doesn't understand the nuance and subtleties. The point then with secret relationships is everyone who works with me, and most of our friends, because I just do it by habit, but I have my printer in mind right now, a lovely lady named Rebel Masters. Rebel thinks, and it's not totally without truth, that she and I have a relationship different from everybody else. You know, I tell her things and tell her not to repeat them and share with her things you wouldn't normally share with a printer. As a result, I get paying the same price everybody else does and probably not her biggest customer. I get super-duper service because we're almost like a brother and a sister. I'll give you a structural example of this. Ray Considine was one of my mentors. Dear friend of mine died 4 years ago, I guess it's been now, at age 91, looking far better than I do now at 67.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Who was he?
He was a direct mail guy, salesman, speaker, sort of earned his spurs in the direct mail business, but he was a male model as a young man, tall, regal-looking, 6'3", I'm guessing, straight back to the day he died, snow-white hair early on. When I first met him, it was sort of sandy brown, but it was snow-white rather quickly. Big, dark, Hollywood-type glasses. When he walked into a room, nobody ever heard of Ray Conn. I mean, he was a lesser star name-wise than Zig or me or anybody. But I'd walk into the room, people go, hi, how you doing? You know, Ray'd walk into a room, and you'd hear in a restaurant the sound volume drop as people said, you know, who is that? He was handsome. He wasn't that stunningly handsome. He just looked important as hell. Later in his career, we were talking one day, and I said, you know, next time you're out doing something, call me and let me know. We generally did anyway, but I said, I'll go farther than I used to because neither one of us is going to be around here forever. And he said, Ben, I'm getting on in years, and a lot of my contacts have died. You know, there used to be people that called him into their yearly convention every year for 25 years. But whoever did that died, and the new guy has his friends. You know, he said, so a lot of my contacts have died off. This conversation was probably when he was in his mid-80s. And over the remaining years, he died at 91 or 92. I heard other little pin drops like that. One day, his son, who I rarely talk to, called me, and he said, Ben, this is Chris Considine. I said, oh, I'm not going to like this call, am I? And he said, no, you're not. Ray died last night. I said, I didn't know he was in the hospital. And he said, you got that email that said he wasn't feeling real well, but don't make a big deal out of it. Well, he was going in for something like open-heart surgery or something. So I said, I'm so sorry. I didn't know. He said, well, we're going to have a little service for him in 2 days in Pasadena. So I broke some appointments because I decided that since I was Ray Considine's best friend, had been for 35 or 40 years. I should be there because all of his friends have died off, and I'd hate the family, you know, to be there by themselves. So I drive. I hate flying if I have a choice. It's not fear of flying. I hate the hassle. So I drove from Northern California to Pasadena, not a short drive, spent the night in a hotel the night before, and then went over, wanted to get there early so that there wasn't a moment when Ray's coffin was alone, you know, and walked in. I was probably 5 minutes before the service. I got the last seat in a rather large church, and I looked around, saw several familiar faces Ray had introduced me to over the years. I've never seen so many bright sport coats and bad toupees, that Hollywood crowd that can't go bald, if you know what I mean, but also much younger people, older people, and so on. And then they said, we're going to have some people come forward, and since we've given them all warning that they're going to speak, we're not going to put you on the spot. You don't have to come up and make up something. We've got the roster set up. And I thought, God, I don't remember. It doesn't make any difference. I can do it anyway if I don't start crying, but I don't remember Chris saying that. I'm sitting there getting my thoughts together, listening to the 15 other speakers, and that part of the program ended. I wasn't one of the 15 speakers. And then these people are crying and sobbing, and Ray's my best friend, and I've known him for this, and he did this for me, and he did this, and there'll never be another Ray Considine. I remember one guy saying, they said, you'll get over him in time, you know, over the pain. He said, I'm not ever getting over Ray Considine. So when we left, some dear friends of mine from up here, who drove down for pretty much the same reason, we met in the lobby, and I said, I feel like Shirley MacLaine in a movie where her husband dies, and she goes to the funeral, and there's 25 other wives and mistresses sitting there. She thought she was the only wife, and the first line of the movie would be, you are one of many.
So that's what you mean by the secret relationship.
Ray Considine sincerely made me believe for the better part of 40 years, I guess, looking back 70, about 40 years, made me believe I was his best friend on earth. And I don't take the fact that I was one of many best friends on earth to be insincere on his part. That's just the way he was. But he built, he never used the term, that was sort of my term, he built secret relationships with everybody. And as a result, he always got the best tables and restaurants. I think somewhere in my book I write about the yellow door. Ray always said, somewhere there's always a yellow door. He was talking about the story. He goes to the World's Fair, whatever it was, in New York. And the AT&T exhibit, I don't know what they were doing in there, probably a futuristic type thing, was the most popular place. And the line was 4 hours long. And he's standing in line. He looks over, and he sees a yellow door over on the side of the building, like a service entrance or something. He goes over, knocks on it, has a typical Ray Considine conversation with whoever opens the door, and he and his wife are suddenly inside the exhibit, not at the head of the line, just in the exhibit. There was no line for Ray Considine. He'd laugh when he told the story, and he said, Ben, always look around. There's always a yellow door. And when you get there, be prepared to make a friend. You want to talk about the prison stuff next? I worked at San Quentin for 5 years running my People Builders program, and that might be a story too, how I got there and why I did it and so on, but never mind that for now. Went in every Friday night, 6 o'clock, worked 12 hours to 6 Saturday morning, holding seminars initially just for the inmates and then a separate class for the staff, but eventually I blended them together, and inmates and staff families all went to the same seminar once a week. Some of them for years, many of them for just a 12-week cycle. As sometimes they do, I tell a story in seminars when appropriate, told it all my smaller seminars where people spend a little more money to come for a public speaking class or something. I tell part A and B. Part A is I worked at San Quentin as a consultant, in and out, made lots of friends. Some of them are still good friends to this day among staff and inmates. Met Charlie Manson, spent time in his cell, 3 times, I think, for a couple hours each visit. So I spent about 6 hours up close and personal with Charlie and lots of other people that were actually worse than Charlie, but not as famous for some reason. And that's part A. And when prison comes up, if somebody would say, you know, was he in prison? Invariably, I'll hear somebody near him say, no, he taught at San Quentin, that People Builders course. Oh, I see. I was confused when he mentioned prison. Well, part B of the story is in 1986, while running a distributor-type business, distributor meaning you buy inventory and go sell it, my offices were raided by the federal government, postal inspectors, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, really? In 86?
86.
Who were you with then?
I was running National Toll-Free Marketing, which is the business that caused the problem, or maybe I caused the problem.
Was it multi-level?
Well, the government said it was, but it wasn't. We sold product at a 65% discount to you, and you went off and built your sales organization, or didn't. You could sell the product yourself at a huge thing. We didn't have levels or the computer ability to do all that and so on. But, of course, the government, once they say you're multi-level, you are.
Okay, so they came in and took everything.
Yeah, took everything, left the original business standing, the National Communication Center, the call center. I opened the first call center in the world.
Right, I remember that.
But National Toll-Free Marketing was, you know, we were in the same building with the same people, and except on corporate papers, you couldn't have seen the difference. But anyway, National Toll-Free Marketing was raided. It eventually caused the collapse of a very profitable, successful business, the National Communication Center, and we went into a four-year lull. Occasionally, I would hear that the government talked to a friend of mine or something. The friend would call me and say, you know, they called me down and talked to me, and then 6 months would go by and nothing, and so on. So about 4 years go by, so I guess you could say I started a new company, was selling the closers material, et cetera, which was part of the distributor business. The government was trying to prove you couldn't sell it. I've been selling it for 30 years very successfully. So about 4 years go by, and one Saturday morning I get up to go get my hair cut, and I glance at the paper, and it wasn't a huge story, but in the Sacramento Bee, somewhere in the part of the paper I would have flipped to pretty quickly because I didn't sit down and read the whole paper, it said Cameron Park, that's a little subdivision I lived in at the time, Cameron Park con man indicted. I remember thinking, God, who is that? I know almost everybody in town.
Oh, my God.
It was me.
Oh, my God. And you didn't know you'd been indicted?
No. First of all, my conscience was clear. I wasn't doing anything wrong, except the stupidity, perhaps, of getting into a business that I know the government instinctively doesn't like. But they don't go after Avon when 200% of their people fail, and they don't go after Amway when only 2 or 3% of their people succeed. But yeah, the reason is, primarily, they haven't got time to chase around $35 and $40 and $100 cases. And for $30 and $40 and $100, nobody complains. You know, you don't write to the Attorney General trying to get your $30 back, and if you do, they throw it in the trash can. Where you could join my business for free, it was not unlike Holiday Magic in that if you wanted the big discounts locked in, then you had to either sell a certain amount in a month or buy a certain amount in a month. And that certain amount was $24,625.13.
So what happened?
One distributor, we had thousands of them, one distributor wanted all of his money back, but he wanted to keep his product. And I said, no, if I'd sent him a check for $7,000, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. But I didn't, and I said, absolutely not. Well, it turned out his name was Brad Evans. I'm happy to report he choked to death on a condom in a cheap hotel in Florida before the trial started, so he didn't get to testify against me. So I turned to my lawyer when I heard that, and I said, we've already won.
Oh, my God.
Evil guy is dead. We've won. But he stayed on it and stayed on it and stayed on it, and he must have been a better salesman than I was because he convinced somebody we were evil and we had all these people and blah, 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 and so on. So government wrote, after we were indicted, to every single distributor we had.
How many?
At the top level, it was about 12,000. Wrote to every single one of them and said, we think, you know, maybe there was something you should know. But meanwhile, these people are sitting there with cosmetics and vitamins and resaleable product, closers and so on. So we think there was a cry. I don't know why. I never saw the letter, but it was, you know, we're here to help. They got zero responses back. Zero. So then they wrote a letter that they knew was untrue, saying, as we told you, we think there's something wrong here, and we think we can get you your money back. Well, tell 12,000 people they can get all their money back without working and so on. 64 of them responded. That's nothing. And some of those, not all of them, but some of those wound up testifying against us at trial. They also indicted my wife at the time and most of my good friends, because most of my good friends were the top salespeople and officers in the company. Somewhere along the line, they offered me 3 years in prison, and checking with my lawyer, he says, well, in 3 years, there's two types of sentencing. One is now gone. It's called old law, and that's what I was under. Old law is you do a third of your time minimum, or two-thirds of your time maximum, unless you stab a guard or something, you could probably run it up to some higher number. So he said nobody got hurt, and the vast majority of people are happy, obviously. And the judge even said on the record he didn't understand why you were indicted, and he couldn't understand the indictment. This is before the trial started. So he said, I think we can beat it. I, being naive, my fault, said, fine, let's go for it. And sat down with my family. I said, I don't want to say I'm guilty of something I'm not guilty of. And I got 125 people here in town who work for us. Most of them have been with us for years. They know we weren't doing anything wrong. Now, if I say I'm guilty, all of a sudden I'm this crook they work for unknowingly.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. Were there a bunch of charges or just...
Well, there were 64 count mm-hmm. against me, but they were all basically the same thing. Each person that complained made that account, and they all revolved around mail fraud. As soon as you see that, that means the government has thrown you under the big umbrella. So, believing I was innocent, believing we could win the case, I went to trial. It turned into the longest trial in the 9th District, where Sacramento is located, in the 9th District's history, at least of a white-collar crime. It was a year long from beginning to end. That means 4 or 5 days a week. I had to drive down to Sacramento in the rush hour traffic both ways, sit there in court and hear myself call a no good, because the vast majority was the prosecution's case. Out of the 12 months, I probably spent 10 and a half months listening to what a creep I was and all my friends. So I encouraged my friends. I said, take the best deal you can whenever you can and plead out. I'm going to be the last man over the side. I'm not going to leave any of you behind because I don't think we did anything wrong. And when I testified, I even said, understand, nothing went out of that office that I didn't either write personally, even had somebody else's signature, or approve, including all the publications they've been holding up. I'm here to defend the business and my honor, but if anyone gets convicted, it should be me, not any of these, and I think there were at that time 6 or 8 co-defendants still sitting there. None of those people. That's how confident I was in our position. 12 months later, the jury's out for about 3 hours. 12 months of testimony. 5,000 documents. They're out for like 3 hours. Including lunch and electing a foreman, and come back and find me guilty on all counts. So I said, all right, I got to do my year. Mm-hmm. I've wasted a year. I'd be done with my time if I'd spent it in jail or in prison instead of sitting here in this courtroom. But you roll the dice, you take your chances. So on sentencing day, I go up and stand in front of the judge, who we were not buddies, but you know, when you see somebody that long, he wasn't a stranger to me. I said, good morning, Judge Schwartz, how are you? Good morning, Mr. Gay, how are you? And blah, 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 and I hereby sentence you to 15 years. Have you ever seen one of those cartoons where when they're scared or nervous...
Their eyes bug out?
Well, eyes bug out a little bit, but the sweat pops off their forehead.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, cartoonists didn't make that up. The body is capable of doing that. But I stood there looking brave, and, you know, I'd already handed my wallet to my wife under the theory of I won't be needing this for a while. It turned out this whole thing was treated like I was never handcuffed, never arrested, never anything. And then I'm thinking, all right, when does the guy come out and handcuff me? And he said, well, we'll arrange the time for your self-surrender with your attorney and so on. Have a good day, which is wonderful. Have a good day. So we left again. And I didn't have to self-surrender for another 6 months. Then I drove myself up to the gate in Lompoc, California, and I sincerely believed I'd win the appeal, so this was to me even. And we took it all the way to Supreme Court. By the time you get to the Supreme Court, if you're not really facing a constitutional issue, I think the secretary stamps it denied. Nobody sat around and had a big discussion about it. They just said there's no constitutional issue here. 12 people heard the evidence and found him guilty, end of story. But we did appeal all the way to the Supreme Court. So for the first 6 months I was there, every time the intercom came on, I would tell whoever I was talking to, shh, because I thought it was going to say, Mr. Gay, report to the offices. We discovered this is all a big mistake.
Right. So where were you?
There are 3 facilities at Lompoc. One is the big house, you know, the place you don't want to be. Then there's the FCI, that's medium security. You walk around loosely, almost like a college campus. There's 3 rings of fence around it with armed guards driving around. No towers, but armed guards driving around the perimeter. Well, I was sent to a camp. A friend who drove me down pulled up in front of the big house, and I was reading a book or something, trying to pretend like this wasn't happening. And I look up and I said, no, John, you know, I'd spend enough time at San Quentin to know what a camp looks like. And that wasn't it. I said, it must be somewhere else. So we drove around, pulled up to a place a little less foreboding, and I got out and I said, hi, my name's Ben Gay. I'm self-surrendering today, but I'm trying to find the camp. And I know this isn't it, so I point to some mobile homes across the highway scattered among this barren-looking land. And I said, is that the camp over there? And the guy said, no, that's staff housing. It's where I live.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I'm off to a good start, as usual. Well, it turned out they had closed down the camp, put a fence around it, turned it into an FCI, and they were going to build a camp any minute. Well, they didn't get it finished to where I could go because I'm not a construction worker for 19 months. So I spent 19 months in the FCI, including the first day I missed a count. I asked a guard, I should know counts. I used to sit in cells during counts. I walked down, took a walk around the compound and saw the chapel, and I walked up to a female guard and I said, hi, I'm new here. Am I allowed to go in there for the inmates? She said, sure. She didn't say sure, but the count is in 15 minutes. She said, sure.
Well, so you missed your count on your first day?
My first day. They had probably had one during the night I wasn't aware of, you know, when you're asleep. The first one that I could be awake and attend voluntarily, I'm sitting in the chapel. And about an hour and a half later, maybe 2 hours, I decide to wander on up to the dorm, first stopping by the bathroom. And just as I had arranged myself in this stall, the door gets kicked open. They said, we found him. The whole place had been shut down on visiting day for 2 hours looking for me. They thought I was an unhappy camper and had taken off right off the bat. So for the first time in this entire 4 or 5 year experience, I'm handcuffed. They said, you're under arrest. I said, under arrest? I'm in prison. They said, no, you're really under arrest now. And they took me over to the big house, put me in solitary confinement in the hole with the bad guys. Now, I self-surrendered on a Friday, so Thursday I was still in my office, and this is Saturday morning. Thursday, before my attorney called and said, you got to show up tomorrow, I mean, he must have known sooner, but he called and said, you got to show up tomorrow. I was holding a board meeting, suit and tie, looking good. And that's Thursday. Friday, I'm driving to prison. Saturday, I'm in solitary confinement in a maximum security prison. I sat down. They stripped me. They took my shoelaces so I wouldn't commit suicide. I had no intentions of committing suicide. I was going to win my appeal. Sat down in this steel bunk. They didn't give me a mattress. There was an old dirty sheet on it, which I swore I would never touch, but when it gets cold enough, you'll touch it. And I sat on the bunk, looked up at the ceiling. I said, all right, God, you have my undivided attention.
Yeah.
Tell me what you want. You know, it finally dawned on me this wasn't just going to go away. Like, I've always been sort of lucky. First of all, I never thought they'd raid us. When they raid us, I didn't think it amounted to anything but an inconvenience. They didn't know there was a grand jury meeting. Didn't know they didn't like me. Didn't know until I read in the paper. I'll tell you a cute story. You swap your clothes almost immediately before you can get issued anything of any seriousness. So I'm walking across the compound with a lady who came down to meet me, a staff member. And she said, Mr. Gay, welcome. You know, we've heard about you, know about your work at San Quentin. This isn't going to be a problem for you. You just keep your head down till you get your bearings and everything will go fine. I said, great, thank you. So we're walking along, and this black guy comes running across the campus, leaping up and down. I thought, great, I'm in a mental institution. Leaping up and down, but as he gets closer, he says, Mr. Gay, Mr. Gay. And he jumps into my arms, almost knocks me down. We spin around two or three times. And he said, do you remember me? And I said, you look awful familiar. Please help me. He said, I'm Albert King. I was in your class at San Quentin, People Builders. I said, Albert, I remember you. Yes, you know, how great. And he says, are you going to do those classes here? And I said, well, I hope so. You know, I'm just here for the first day. But I hope to teach public speaking and sales and marketing, how to get out of prison, stay out of prison. You know, that was all the People Builders thing. And he said, great, which I did wind up doing for years. So he says, fantastic, and he backs off like, I want to get a good look at you. Well, the last time he saw me, I was in a tailor-made $2,000 three-piece suit looking good. He sort of stuttering, said, how come they got you dressed like that? Albert, I is
Oh, my God.
And there were two or three other people in there who'd gone through the class, so I guess they had upgraded their crimes. They were no longer state people. Now they're federal people.
How long were you in solitary for?
Just 5 days. Until they were convinced I really wasn't trying to escape, until they got my undivided attention, which they did. I never missed a count again. As I used to tell my friends, and I sort of became the greeting committee for new people coming in, because I knew how it was for new people, so I always went out of my way to introduce myself to anybody new and say, I'm here to help you and get you settled in, get you some sweatpants.
You didn't get to go back to the minimum security?
Yeah, medium.
You did go back there?
Yeah, after 5 days, went back to medium security and the FCI. And there I was for 19 months, so they got the camp built. It finally came to me one day and said, Mr. Gay, and they called me Mr. Gay. I refused to answer to gay, asshole, you know, all the things they yell. So they said, Mr. Gay, I didn't turn around. It took me about 3 days to get all the staff to refer to me as Mr. Gay. Some of my people have been there a little longer. One for 14 years. He said, I've been here 14 years in prison in general. He said, I've never seen an inmate called Mr. anything. How did you do that? I said, I don't answer to anything else. They're not going to shoot you for not answering. Matter of behavioral modification. But anyway, one day they came up to me to discuss the camp, and they said, Mr. Gay, we know you don't like to get your hands dirty. I worked in the education department and taught most of the time in the FCI, but we think the camp is now up to your level of acceptance. I said, well, great, send me over. So, you know, there's a little more freedom. And over there, the only thing keeps you from running away is a split rail fence about 3 feet tall. So if you wanted to take off and add 5 years to your sentence, you can. And rather quickly, I was running the regional warehouse as the head clerk. Did you ever see Shawshank Redemption?
Yeah.
Well, friends of mine who've seen it, who also were aware of my prison experience, say that that was me, minus the violence and stuff. But my point is, you get in a position where you're really important and where the guards are taking things from you they shouldn't, like I help fill out their tax returns, their employment applications for the next level. And because it was a warehouse where all the food was kept, I had an office full of food, and one of my co-inmates, dear friend of mine still today, had owned a restaurant. So we had the best food in the world, working with just a fry pan, microwave, razor blades to cut up the garlic and stuff, and a refrigerator we stole out of the warden's house while it was being remodeled. We didn't. We swapped out some stuff, and the people who were remodeling it brought it over and hauled it upstairs and put it in our bathroom. So we had refrigeration and cooking utilities and all the food that was available in the three facilities then with the camp open started in our warehouse. And that ingratiated me to the cooks, the staff who ran the kitchen, because I would call them. The big house would come over and steal all the good food, so I would call them, the people in the camp, say, the food's here, get over here now. And they would come racing over, and I'd send them extra stuff and get extra clothing for the people. So rather quickly, I got in a position where I was respectful and polite and, you know, treated everybody decently, staff and inmates. But I got in a position where it would have been sort of difficult on short notice to run the warehouse without me. That made me immune from the whole. I was threatened a couple of times. One time, 60 pounds of shrimp that was headed to a warden's party disappeared. And I truly didn't know what happened to it. But if you're working in a warehouse, you were from the camp, so it didn't take a genius to figure out either the staff stole it, and they would do that frequently. You could always tell when pork chops or something were arriving at the warehouse when we pulled up in the morning. There'd be four or five staff cars with the trunks open. But I didn't know where the 60 pounds of shrimp was. So when they couldn't get anybody to fess up, Jay Ledford, the head of the staff that ran the warehouse, came up and said, all right, everybody up, we're all going to the hole. I turned around, put my hands behind my back, and I said, Jay, you're going to have a lot of fun running this warehouse since you don't know any of the systems. And the reason he didn't was when I took over the job from a guy who'd had the job for 10 years, he finally went home. I changed all the systems deliberately to better systems, but I didn't bother to tell anybody that I'd done it. I said, I don't know where the shrimp is. I don't care. And as you know, if I did know, I wouldn't tell you. And I'll be happy to go to the hole. I've been there before. I'm not afraid. But in 24 hours or less, you're going to come over and get me because you literally can't run this place without me until I train my replacement. So you want 4,000 or 5,000 inmates scattered around between three institutions starving to death? Have at it.
And what did he do?
He said, all right, Mr. Gay, sit down. He said, are you going to help me find the shrimp? And I said, I honest to God don't know where it is. And then I told probably the only lie I ever told in prison. I said, I'm allergic to shrimp. I'm violently allergic to shrimp. Trust me, I didn't steal it. Oh, okay, and walked away. Well, that's not true, but yeah. I just wanted to end the conversation instead of, come on, I'll give you this if you tell me this, and so on.
Very interesting.
Under the new law, if you get sentenced to 30 years, you can do 85% of it. There is no parole board. Under my sentence, old law, I had to do 5 unless I won an appeal, which I didn't. Could have done 10 unless I stabbed a guard. I didn't, so I'd likely that serving 10 were sort of slim. I wound up serving 6 years, 1 month, 1 day. And probably my good service there, I put hundreds of people, if not thousands, through GED, got them their GEDs. I taught sales, public speaking skills, how to read, how to write. I wrote letters home for people. One of the funny things is I wrote letters for the warden denying claims by the inmate. Well, many inmates couldn't write a letter complaining about whatever they were complaining about. So as a favor to them, they'd say, Mr. Gay, would you help me with this? I would write the letter to the warden. The warden would write no on the top and send it back to me to draft a whole letter, turning down the letter I had written to him. It was sort of like a time warp bizarre situation to be in. I'd make the argument as good as I could going in, and then I had to come back with an even stronger letter from the warden turning it down. They didn't just say no, they always explained why. So I had to overcome my own good arguments, and I was, in essence, writing to myself. The inmate didn't write it, and the warden didn't write it.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. So how old were you when you went in?
I was 48, and the reason I know that was on my 5th day in the hole. It was August 22nd, which is my birthday. And as we came out, I heard somebody say August 22nd. I'd sort of lost track of time. And I said to the guard who was escorting me back over to the FCI, I said, it's my birthday. join in. And I started singing happy birthday to me. And about the second chorus, he joined in. And he said, you've got a great attitude. You're going to do well here. And I said, well, I'm Irish. I have a sense of humor. And I have a feeling I'm going to need it to get through this experience. Literally, I was 5 days before my 48th birthday when I went in. 6 years, 1 month, 1 day later, I came out. While in there, I ran the greatest direct mail program in the history of mankind. I also, by the way, I wrote the closer's part, too, in prison.
Oh, did you? Okay.
In longhand and mailed it home until I got the job in the warehouse and I had access to it.
You already had the rights to the closers.
Yeah. Had been selling that for several years.
What was the direct mail program you put together?
Well, first of all, I mean that seriously and not seriously. The unserious side was I really did write, I don't know, I guess they're both serious, come to think of it. I wrote my newsletter from prison, mailed it home, didn't have to smuggle it. You know, you can mail stuff as long as it's not government property. Of course, it was government property. It was on government paper, typed on a government computer and so on. But still, I wrote the newsletter, wrote the closer's part two, first half of it probably longhand, mailed it home, and they fixed it. And after that, I was able to send it home virtually typeset, ready to be scanned, and wrote the newsletter. And when I first got there, you had to make collect calls home. And it was preceded by, this call is coming to you, collect, from an inmate in a federal institution. That sort of crimped my style. But rather quickly, they, by happenstance, swapped the system where if you had money on your account, when you made a call, it just automatically came off your commissary account. And there was no announcement. Mm-hmm. So I would get messages from the office, written or discussed in a separate conversation where I'd call them. And we were limited to 10 minutes. So I would make phone calls to clients who absolutely had to speak to me. Most clients came to believe I was very, very busy and that whoever they talked to would have to handle it, whatever it was. You know, Mr. Gay is sort of hard to reach. But it was when one I really had to reach, I would call them, and invariably I was in an airport, which accounted for the screaming and the yelling and the intercoms in the background. So there are people who don't believe I was in prison. There were some people in our public speaking class last one we held in San Francisco literally didn't believe I was in prison. They said, during the time period you're talking about, I talked to you on a regular basis. I told the story, and I tell them, if they haven't heard it, I tell them two or three inspirational stories of people overcame whatever, you know, and so on. Broken leg and became a hockey player or whatever. Standard motivational stories. And then I say, let me tell you about a guy who, using the techniques we're talking about today, setting a goal, having a system, but without giving the old seminar, all the things I teach in seminar, this would be about the fourth day of a four-day seminar. I said, let me tell you about a friend of mine named Frank, and I'm not going to tell you his last name because, oddly enough, you'll know it when you hear the story, but most of you know him, or at least know of him. And I tell the story of Frank, who came to his office one day. It was raided. He couldn't believe it. He wasn't doing anything wrong. In his opinion, 12 people disagreed. Year-long trial. Went in while he was in. His wife started an affair with another person. Stole his house. Stole a significant amount of acreage they had, you know, forged documents type thing. Even forged their divorce papers and didn't steal the business. She didn't know how to run that, but destroyed the business. Jump ahead of the story. When I left, we were making about, $40,000 a month before my salary or whatever, but making about $40,000 a month.
Now, what were you making the money with?
Closers.
Oh, with the closers business. Okay.
Yeah, the closers. But I leave, we're making $40,000 a month profit. I come back, we're grossing $4,000 a month instead of making $40,000, and the business is, I don't remember now, $140,000 in debt. People are banging on the doors and so on. But I'm grateful, one, the evil Carlotta was gone, which freed me up to marry Gigi, who I'd known since the first week when I was up here 33 years ago as we speak, to pursue her anyway. And the P.O. box was still good, same box I've had for 33 years, and the 800 number still worked. So I had over a million copies of the book out floating around with no website in it because I didn't know anything about websites and no email, but at least the phone number and P.O. box. So some business was coming in, and I could contact people and rejuvenate them. So I got the toehold I needed. So one campaign is I continue to run the business, buy mail order, writing copy, having them print it and send it out and so on. But that's sort of part A and B. Part A was San Quentin, voluntary. Part B was Lompoc for 6 years, 1 month, 1 day, involuntary. Sounds like about what Glenn went through, because I think in your cover letter you said he spent 5 years in an Arizona prison.
Right.
Was that federal or state?
I think it was federal.
If it was, it wouldn't surprise me because his home is in Florida. So the federales, not always. but they try not to make it easy on you. Your family's in Florida. Here's an idea. We'll send you to Arizona. There was, now it's a woman's prison, but then it was co-ed about 45 minutes from my house. They could have sent me there, instead they sent me to Lompoc, you know, at the other end of the state.
Do you talk about your prison experience in some of your seminars and the stuff you do?
I do it in all seminars that are small and intimate, where we're getting really good at some. If I'm talking to 1,000 people and they're salespeople, I will tell the story if it's appropriate. Let me tell you something amazing. The first time I told the story, I'd been out of prison 10 days, and I did a seminar. Well, the first one I did was in Mexico. The next one I did, I probably been out of prison 30 days. It was in Portland, Oregon. And I said, does all this stuff work? Yeah, I'm standing in front of you. You just paid me $10,000 to give a talk. You just bought whatever, $20,000 worth of product, and you want to know if it works? Folks, I've been out of federal prison for about 30 days. Of course it works. And then I told them the story. Then we broke for lunch or dinner or whatever. And out of a crowd of, I don't know, 150 maybe people. It wasn't a huge seminar, but it was everybody in that company, pretty substantial group. I think it was 4 people came up and sort of, if there was a secret handshake, they gave it to me. It was sort of like pull me in close. Thank you for saying that out loud. I went through that too. And in the San Francisco seminar, a guy who's got the best voice I've ever heard in my life, top salesman in his field, comes up to me and he says, I'm amazed you told the story and I really appreciate it. I'm surprised we didn't meet at San Quentin. And I said, oh, why would I have met you at San Quentin? Were you teaching courses there? He said, no, I was there.
Wow.
He had spent state time. And one other person had served some, wasn't very serious, but some amount of time. But in every group I've told the story, people come up, and sometimes very surprising people, like the owner of the company or what have you. And I think Michael Milken, one of the guys who lived right next door to me in the next cube, we weren't in cells in the camp, more dormitory style.
Yeah, he was there?
Well, Michael Milken was at the camp I should have gone to, the co-ed camp at Pleasanton, because that was far away from his house, so they sent him there. But Michael Milken's top guy was in the bunk next, and his name was Wes Shear, Jewish guy who became an Indian while he was there so he could spend time out at the sweat lodge and not have to deal with the prison.
Was there anyone else indicted from your organization?
Well, there were 6 or 7 indicted because I took full responsibility. I was the only one that drew jail time. Everybody else pled out and were given probation and fine. And 3 of us went right to the end, were found guilty, but they only got probation.
How much did you spend on your defense?
I probably would have spent $200,000. Had I hired an attorney, but the government knew what losing the business and all had taken on me while claiming in trial I was rich and had all this money hidden away. They indicted me and appointed me a public defender on the first day.
So you went through with a public defender?
Yeah, but my point being, they knew I could get a public defender because of financial stress, but in court, they maintained that I was rich. They knew better. That's the reason I had a public defender sitting next to me.
Could you have gotten your own representation?
Oh, yeah. I interviewed several people. I had a public defender who seemed to be reasonably competent. I could question that now. My only point of questioning wasn't very powerful. My only real complaint with him is he should have told me, take the deal, and explained it to me in detail. He let me go through a year-long trial under the impression that the worst that could happen is I'd be sentenced to the 3 years they offered me, not knowing after you tie up a judge's courtroom for a year, all bets are off.
Oh, I see. So the deal would have been the 3 years, and you would only serve maybe
14 months or something. Yeah, that was a disservice. He wanted to make the $70 an hour, whatever they pay public defenders, and it's not like a one-time discussion that he didn't handle well. I said numerous times as the trial went on, you roll with ICE, and so I do a year, so what? In fact, I even said, after your sentence, you go to a pre-sentencing report officer or something. They write up a PSI, pre-sentencing investigation. And I went to her immediately afterwards and didn't realize the seriousness of it when you're in prison. Everything in prison is based on your PSI, as if God gave it to Moses. And my attorney didn't go to that with me. He said, well, you know, you can go up there. There's no problem. I got another case I got to do, and we'll be in touch. We'll appeal this. And I thought, not with you, we won't. But I go up, and I had this meeting, and I remember seeing the lady. She says, how are you feeling? I said, a little beaten up. I didn't expect to be found guilty. And this is found guilty before your sentence. And I said, but if somebody has to do a year or two for this, it ought to be me. I was head of the company. She must have been in hysterics on the inside, because that isn't what they had in mind. but as recently, I guess it's the day I was sentenced and talking to her, I still believed I was going to do a year, no more than 2 years. So I'm clearly saying to you, if somebody's got to do it, might as well be me. What do you want to know? Here's a pre-sentencing thing that was wrong, but worked to my advantage. They wrote in the pre-sentencing report that they sincerely believed I had $26 million in cash somewhere. This from a government who took all the records we had with them and knew better. We didn't gross $26 million in the 10 years it was in business. And they knew that, you know, what was in the bank balance and knew how little I was.
Was that business going for 10 years?
Yeah, from 1976 to 1986. So they knew it, but she put in the sentencing report $26 million. Well, only certain people in prison are supposed to read your pre-sentencing report. You're a counselor, and I say that with a smile.
Yeah.
You know, the guard who didn't want to be in dangerous places, so he said, I'll be a counselor, and people like that. But the reality is, guys got nothing to do at 2 o'clock in the morning. He's sitting in the guard hut. He goes in, opens up the file, and reads what he wants to read. So rather quickly, word got around, I had $26 million in cash somewhere. That day, I was already being treated well. I was already.
So you were treated well because of that?
Well, I was treated well because I'm semi-clever and good at what I do and have secret relationships with guards.
Yeah.
Relationship with everybody. But from that day forward, I was treated even better. A guy whose name I can't think of, it was there, Haldeman there, and were there before me, and so they'd have some other famous people go through, but there was a guy who was one of the first financial guys, Bernie somebody, or it doesn't make any difference.
All right.
Anyway, whoever he was had gone through before me, and when he got a cush job somewhere and was taken care of pretty well by the head of the ranch. They have cattle and everything. Mm-hmm. He worked on the ranch. And mysteriously, about 6 months after he left, having been treated well, the head of the ranch thing got a BMW. So, you know, I always was under the impression they thought that maybe there was a BMW in their future for me after I got out.
Right. Wow, Ben. Man, I really appreciate you opening up about this. I'm sure it's probably not really easy to talk about it, and I appreciate you caring enough to share your story with me. And what a story that was, and I'm sure your story will be beneficial for a lot of my listeners. Really, thank you very, very much for sharing this. I really appreciate it. That's the end of my interview with Ben Gay III. I hope this has been enjoyable, and please listen to parts 1 and 2 of the interviews with Ben Gay. You can search the words Ben Gay interview on Google to find them. Okay, take care. For more interviews like this, go to hardtofindseminars.com.